Okay, let's start. So yesterday, I may remind you, we have introduced a small example programming language for which which might serve as an intermediate representation of our high-level of our program written in a high-level language, and we started to look at possibilities to improve the code. And so the first thing what we wanted to look at was at repeated computations, and that means repeated evaluation of the same expression. And again, I may remind you, this such expressions occur, for example, for address calculations, when the same address expression may easily occur multiple times in the code, and always refer to the same address. So we would like to remove these repeated computations. And there we found out that we can do so and replace the repeated evaluation of the same expression by a lookup. If you store away the value which you have already computed. If you do so, this is possible, but only under certain assumptions. And now we wanted to be sure that we kind of have the real assumptions, which are sufficient. So for that, we need something as to know, yes, this definitely will be evaluated before the second evaluation of the same expression, and that it really the second evaluation of the same expression returns the same result. So these are kind of questions or properties which refer to the operational semantics. And whether it is so or not depends on what the operational semantics of our programming language is. So by that, I hope I have convinced you that there is a need for something like an operational semantics. And once we have that, we then have to realize some kind of method to do the computations, the required computations on some kind of representation of the program to identify cases where it is safe to apply our optimization idea. Yeah, so that is these two kind of obligations we now have: operational semantics and then some kind of algorithmic framework to do to check some kind of semantic property. So let us start with the operational semantics. So how do we do it? So in principle, the operational semantics is given in some sense by, yeah, what is it? So by the computer. Yeah. So that the computer performs steps, and somehow the operational semantics should kind of mirror that, but in a way which is independent of the hardware. And what people there typically do is they provide something like small step operational semantics. So the idea there is to define small step, to define small steps. So these are kind of, if you like, the atoms of computation. And then these atoms somehow have to be realized by the hardware. And then a program execution then consists of a sequence of that atoms. So that is the idea. So now at which granularity, it depends on at which granularity do we define the computation. So we could do it in the granularity of the real hardware, which is kind of loading the instruction, decoding the instruction, then each instruction then consists of a sequence of faces, and that is a bit awkward, and that is far away from the real, from the programming language. So therefore one is more abstract, and then says, okay, maybe an addition is an atomic operation. But here we will be even more coarse-grained. For us, just evaluating such an assignment, that is an atomic operation for us. Yeah, but again, so that is this allows us to decompose the computation into atoms, but these atoms itself are kind of already complex operations which refer to quite a sequence of activities of the hardware. But we want to be slightly away from the hardware, so we are content with that. This serves our needs, but for different purposes it might be required to go even down and be more concrete with the semantics. But we, as long as we can go with that, we are happy. So just for a side remark, could you conceive a situation where it might be required to go even more down to the hardware and decompose even such kind of assignments into individual steps? So this is, for example, if you want to access, for example, the energy consumption of something, then you really have to know what's going on when you do this and that operation, or when you have when you are interested in the timing behavior of what we are doing. So timing behavior is crucial if you have real-time systems controlling, say, like if you have a cyber-physical system, then you must really know it's not just that there is an assignment. You have to know what time is used by that assignment, and that means you how long will it take the processor, the real processor of a very concrete CPU, to perform that operation. And then you have in detail to look at what's going on in the hardware. But for us, we are at the moment, we are a little bit more relaxed. Therefore, this kind of operational semantics. Okay? So now I have talked that we need something like steps, and we need something how one step may follow another step. And that kind of coordination of different operations, this is modeled by a very convenient tool. These are control flow graphs. I guess you all have have encountered control flow graphs so far in your life. So therefore, I may just briefly recollect what we do. So there are, in the control flow graph, there are control points, and there are transitions between these control points. So the points are the place where you are during program, which you might have reached during program execution. It could be a position in the code. And then in between you have edges, which are the actions. These, in this case, it is, for example, an assignment. Yeah? This happens between by the transition from one control point to the other. yeah. So that means, so this is the control flow graph is a graph which has vertices and which has edges. The vertices correspond to the program points and the edges to the steps of the computation. And then there is a designated start point, which is where execution starts, and an end point, that is where the execution, which is reached when the once the execution has terminated. So thinking of of a procedure, if our control flow graph represents a procedure, then the start point is the entry point of the procedure, and the stop, that is when the return point, where you kind of exit the procedure. Okay? I may kind of, so here you see a little bit, a little piece of such a thing. So here you have the start point. Here you have one of these steps executed, reaching then the next program point, and so on. And here is something strange happening. So here the control flow goes in two directions. This happens at conditions. So that the condition may be true or false, and in the one case you go to the left and in the other to the right. So the direction depends on what value you obtain there. So here this is mirrored, modeled in that, such a way that the condition is duplicated and it's kind of used as a guard. So one is the positive side, so therefore this pos, and the other thing is the negative side of the condition. This is the neg thing. So you could think of it all, so it depends on, now it also depends on the semantics of our language, what the condition, whether it returns true or false, or whether it returns non-zero or zero. So I guess in the end we will, for simplicity, assume that we have only ints as values, and then the value of a condition will be also an int, which is non-zero or zero. So that means the pos means non-zero and the neg then means zero. Okay? So these are now, so the conditional branching means two edges, and each of these two outgoing edges of such a branching thing is a guard, which may either succeed, and then it's fine, you may proceed, or it may fail, and then you cannot proceed. Okay? Yeah. so here is then the, so these edges, therefore, which describe the transition from one program point to another, they are labeled with the action going on. And so the main action, which I have already explained to you, this is this assignment. But there are other actions. So that you could read from memory, you could write to memory, or you could kind of have these tests to check whether a condition holds or does not hold. And there is the most important action, which is the no-op, so nothing happens. Okay? So I think it's pretty simple and easy to understand. There's perhaps not to elaborate, but to remind you that there is some kind of, sometimes people make a different choice. So then the actions are the program, kind of are the boxes in the control flow graph, the nodes, the vertices, and the edges kind of are between these actions. So I find that counterintuitive, and therefore will not follow that path here. Now, so with this kind of model, this control flow graphs, with these actions, then we kind of may agree that a computation then consists of a sequence of actions, and that means it follows one of these paths in the control flow graph. And it should, in the end, a complete computation may start at start and go to end, but there could also be partial computations which start somewhere and end somewhere. And each of these computations is a sequence of actions. So each action has some kind of effect. So if I do an assignment, that means some variable changes its value. So therefore, if I speak about the semantics of what happens, what is the result of the computation, I must track how the program state changes by the actions. So this kind of change, now what is the program state? So here, in general, so in the real world, what is the program state? The state of execution in your real computer. What is it? Is it difficult? Is it easy? No, it can't be so difficult. Please tell me. Yes. So in some sense, it's all the hardware somehow. Everything where you can store a bit, a byte, there it is. So it is, means it is not, it is the values of the registers. It's in some sense the values. So if you are very down to hardware, it's the registers, it's the cache, it's the main memory. And then it's even the peripheral status of the file system. That would all be, all this comprises the state of the program. But if you are in a programming language setting, then you might not ignore, then you do not know about caches and things like, and registers, then it would be the variables on all levels, and even the data structures which you have, the dynamic data structures which you have somewhere in your heap. But additionally, all those, if you want to have the really complete program state, then you also should take into account all the files which are opened and accessed. So, and if you want to be very precise in what your program, what an action of your program does, then you have to report the changes to all these components in your program. This is tedious, but here in our little language, we can be. So we have no file system, and we have no. The only global data structure which we have is this M, this main memory, if you like, and registers or variables, the individual variables in our program. So therefore, it is easy for us to formalize, it's much easier than in the real world to formalize what it means what the program status state means. It means simply the values of the variables and the values of the stored in memory. Yeah. Now and then, the next question is, what kind of values do we store in these there? And in now again in the hardware, on the hardware level, it's all bits and bytes. That's a little bit not so easy to deal with. On the programming language level, it's you have a huge variety of data types, basic data types. You could have, it's not so that you have only, you might have, think of Java, you might have byte, you might have characters, you might have ints, you might have longs, you might have floats and doubles, and so there are a variety of different sizes. So here we make our lives easy. So that is just to make our lives easy. So in the real world, we would have to cope with these other things also. We kind of assume that it's all int. Whatever int is, it is some kind of numerical data type, which allows also to represent addresses and numerical values. We ignore floats, for that doesn't matter for us here. But we could add that. And then that's also, so these are the values which are stored in some location. So here, these are these things here. And then the places, so then we have the variables where we can store something, and then the memory. The memory is addressed by non-negative numbers starting at zero and going, and I don't know where to go. So here I assume it's possibly unbounded. In the real world, there is some maximal address, and then you can't go beyond. So, but we could kind of also add this restriction that there is an upper bound to the number of addresses, but for simplicity, I simply ignore it. A finite computation, by the way, will nevertheless always be able to access finitely many addresses in memory. Okay, so in that sense, this row together with mu, row like registers and mu like memory, represent our program state. So just for simplicity, to have something which is as easy that we can, so easy that we can, with a few lines, describe it in all formality. So, okay, and then now comes, that is the program state. Okay, now we have agreed on that. Now we may wonder what is happening at an action. Well, an action takes a state and then modifies the state. So this means it returns a new state, which is perhaps almost the same as the other one, but in some places different. So it may change the value of some variable. It may change the value of some memory location. So that means we can say the semantics of an edge, which is a step. So this is the semantics, is a kind of a transformation of the state. So that is, so it takes a state and returns a state. And here I say it's a partial transformation. Why is it a partial transformation? There might be states when I may not proceed along this edge. So this means this action cannot be performed. So when can that happen? For example, have you any idea? Why shouldn't I always be able to do a step? So think about here our fabulous list of steps which we have. So we have these tests. We have this, and we have these assignments, and we have this, reads and writes to memory. So, is there some of these? Are these operations always defined? What is your impression? Is this the case?
I would say that a load might not be defined if we don't have
So you go already for one of the most complicated things, but that is definitely true. If I load from a negative location, I might have a problem. Yes?
Maybe it has to always put a negative, so
what did you say? A test may fail, or what did
yeah,
you?
Just always be positive or negative.
Yes, so that's true. So if I have a, if I remember a computation, we consider it as a path. Now, if there is a test, then this means okay, if the test fails, then this path would not be taken. So what would we do in our semantics? Well, we then say this is undefined. So this test, so a test can fail, and in that case, the transformation is simply not defined. Well, otherwise, what should we do? So we could not, cannot do a state transition because there is no state transition. Yeah? So undefined of a test does not mean that the program will explode, but it only means that the program will take another path. But here for the load and the store, that is a serious problem. So if we, if the program has undefined behavior because it loads from an undefined address, so what should happen? And here we can have, we have a problem. So what should, now we could think of what is, what would the compiler do? So the compiler, if it, so it could be, it could try to avoid a program error by doing an analysis and checking that the programmer did the right thing. And that is, it did not, he did not refer to a negative address. That he could do, and that is what we kind of expect from a very smart analyzer. But most compilers would not do it.
Is it really possible to pre-calculate the address to the success if the address is coming from some other location and it's some
sure.
indirect address?
You're perfectly right. It's a dynamic number which is computed somewhere, and so it means to know at compile time what the computation at runtime will do. We will find out later that there are methods to get information about that. And so in some cases, the compiler may check whether such thing is negative, whether negative addresses are possible or not here, and may issue a warning. But in general, the compiler assumes that the programmer knows what he does and that the program is correct. So that it will only provide code which is correct if the original program was meaningful. If the original program was not meaningful, then it could, in principle, could do anything, because if it's not meaningful, it's undefined. So it's like in C, if you have undefined behavior, you can optimize to hello world. Yeah? So that's, in that sense, we kind of could assume simply that it is, the compiler might assume that it will not access a negative address. And if it finds out, it has all chances for optimization. Okay, so but we should keep that in mind, because there are other situations where such runtime errors could occur. You might divide by zero. So what will happen? And that depends also on the semantics, to a certain degree on the semantics of the programming language. If the programming language has built-in checks for such runtime errors, the programming language may demand that an exception is raised. So here in our language, we do not have exceptions. So otherwise, if we want to cope with that, we would have to build that mechanism into our language that exceptions could be raised, and would have to track that in the operational semantics, because that it means a step could also be that an exception is raised and you jump to an exception handler. Yeah. Okay. So that is kind of, so here, so now we have, we kind of got, I hope this little discussion showed you the intricacies and the, or that there are some pitfalls with this transformation things, but at least in principle, it is an easy concept, only that when you try to apply it to real language, you might have to be careful. So here is for our little language what we would do. So we, if the no op, that is the transformation is, I try to describe it here. This means it is the identity transformation. So here the positive and the negative guards of an expression E is, that is, so here you see the, if E, so here it is identity on the left, but under certain assumptions. So this renders this transformation a partial identity. So if the condition which I kind of made in red to the right, if they are not met, then the transformation will be undefined. So the positive expression will be undefined if the E is not satisfied, and that means if it will be undefined if E returns the value zero. So it's only the identity if E is non-zero, returns a non-zero value. And the opposite for the negative thing, there it's E must return zero in order for the identity for the same state to be returned. Otherwise, it would be undefined. Now here I implicitly, and maybe if you look, try to read, not to listen what I'm saying, but try to read what I've written there, you might be wonder what's that. I have introduced some strange new notation here, and also I used here also these kind of weird brackets. So these double brackets, I go back, so I have already introduced them here without commenting on that. So K is the edge. So this is a syntactical thing, if you like. And lab is what I write at the edge also. This is also a syntactical thing. So these double square brackets somehow also always means that they enclose a syntactic piece and say, now I am speaking about what the semantics of that piece is. And the semantics of the edge is a transformation from state to state. And here I refer to what is the value... Here is a transformation from state to state, taking a pair rho comma mu, returning a pair rho comma mu, and here I also put these brackets around an expression. So what is the semantics of an expression? So remember, an expression is a syntactical object, x plus 5. So this is complete, just a piece of a variable name, an operator name, and a name of a constant. So you must see it as a such very syntactical thing. So now what is the semantics of it? Well, the semantics of it is you somehow have to access the value of the x. You have to take the constant and consider it as a value, and then you have to take the operator and apply it to those two things, and then you get a value, which is 5 or 6 or 42 or something. So here's an example so that you see what it concretely, not with E, but with concrete, what it means. So here if I, once again, here you have an example of such an expression. So X plus Y. So sorry that I insist on such stupid things. You all know that, hopefully. So it's just a piece of, which could be, could sit somewhere in your code. So it's just a piece of text, if you like, a syntax. And then what is the meaning of it? The meaning of it is a function which takes the values of the variables and then returns a value, because you evaluate then the expression for these values. So that you apply it to something which gives values to the x. So here, this gives you, say x should have the value 7, y should have the value minus 1. So if this is the case, and then you can, under this assumption, you are able to evaluate what the expression will return. So then the x plus y will be 7 plus minus 1, and that is 6. You can understand that. And intuitively at runtime the same happens. You have you write in your code, x, please compute x plus y, and put the value into set, and then that means at runtime, the runtime system will look up the values of x, the values of y, will add and put the values into the variable set, and so there it needs. So that is kind of an important, this evaluation of expressions with respect to bindings of the variables. This is an important step in an important part of the semantics of programming languages. Could you do these examples kind of help you to understand my weird notation, please?
I have a question, but the bracket
So, yes. So now you wonder about the various kinds of brackets. So we have these brackets. This form a tuple of two things. So, okay, about these brackets I have already spoken. Now, what is that? These brackets. These brackets kind of, I want to describe a function. So a function from a variable name to a contents. And these curly brackets kind of describe a list of these bindings in the function. So inside this curly bracket, so this here, or that here, these correspond to the row. The row is this function mapping the variables to values. And now you may wonder, okay, so why is... This E is a transformation and it is applied to a function, and I only write these two one besides another. And that is something what these functional programmers very much like, that they put the function and its argument simply one besides the other, and they don't put brackets around the argument, because why? If it's a pair, then you would have brackets around brackets. And if it's an individual thing, then it is already an individual thing. So why should you put brackets around it? So brackets is for grouping and not just for something. And so in that sense, so I hope with that stupid explanation, putting this here just besides that means that the left thing is applied to the right thing. Okay? Does it become... now clear? But this weird kind of bracket and the... Please ask. So it's very stupid because very basic, but it's very important, because if you kind of are confused by my weird, by my fancy brackets, then you cannot follow anything what I'm writing. So therefore we should kind of agree on that and then we are done with it.
So
yes, please.
What's the semantics of the expression below?
This one? So that is, so here is another example. So this is, I've removed this. So what is it? So, yellow. So here. This expression. And we see it's X is compared with, for equality with a 4, and then the bang makes negation. So in isolation, we should understand that this is evaluation of expressions, and so a condition is also an expression. This is the only thing which I wanted to show here. And if I have the bindings for the variables in it, and the bindings again are in these curly brackets, then I can evaluate the condition. And in this case, it returns. So X equals 4 returns false. So this is 0. And negation applied to 0 returns 1. So therefore, the expression inside can simply be evaluated as any other expression and returns a number. In this case, 1. So that's this. Now, this gives you. So by that, I hope to have explained that we have a means for an expression to determine the value it returns for a variable binding row. Okay, and given that, we then know what the pose E is. And the pose E is not the same as the E. It's the transformation, the guard, if you like, the effect of the guard E on the state. And the guard E, this edge, means I may either traverse this edge or I may not traverse this edge. So if the condition evaluates, if it is pose E, and E evaluates to something different from 0, then I may traverse this edge, and therefore the transformation is identity. So if it is for, if E returns 0, then this edge is blocked, and then the transformation is undefined. Okay? Does this yet now answer your question? So therefore I have a distinction between E and pos E. So the one thing is an expression and the other one is a guard where the condition to be evaluated is the expression E. Okay? So please, so it's, we should kind of agree on that. So we have, we are not so many, we can kind of be sure about that. Okay. And now then there comes, now is the next thing, the next step, the next kind of transformation, which is slightly more complicated, is this assignment thing. So here we have a left-hand side, which is a plain variable, and the right-hand side, with the, which is an expression. And we assume that we can evaluate this expression to some value. so what do we have to do? We then kind of have to update the row. So this here is the row before the assignment. And now, after the assignment, we have a new row. The new row is obtained by taking the old row and modifying the value at R. So the new value of R will be the value of the right-hand side as determined by taking the old row. Because you first have to evaluate the expression, and only then you modify the variable. Now here we have, I have introduced a new stupid operator. This is this strange plus operator. It is a very simple thing. So we have a function which assigns to the variables their values, and that is, should be modified at one particular place. How do I write it down? And I make it by this plus. So this plus takes kind of everything, takes all the function as provided by the left argument, and on the right side of the plus, it provides the new values for some of the variables, in that case only for the R. So it's kind of an update operator. Okay, so I guess I have an example here also down there, so we may look at this one before we kind of, here I have listed to you what goes on for the loading on and for the storing, but that is, I come to that in a minute. Let us first look what the how the update operator itself behaves. So here we have this x equals x plus 1, and assume that before the assignment we have the value of x is 5, so the row looks like that. So what would, so we know what happens, so afterwards x should have the value 6. Yeah? And the mu is not changed. So that is what so but how do we do in this formalism, how would we write that step by step? So the idea is we have this one, this is the old variable assignment, then we, as at least according to how I have written it down, we would have then here this update operator, and here the new value for the x. And the new value for the x is, we take the x plus 1, which is the right-hand side, and evaluate it with the old variable assignment. Now x plus 1, evaluated with x mapped to 5, gives 6. So therefore, this one here is the same as this one. So therefore, this is kind of the simplification which I did, and now I have x is mapped to 5, and then I have to update this function with x maps to 6, and if we do that, then the result is x maps to 6. Okay? That's just to show you that what I, the, that these, what I, the mathematical nonsense which I have written down there is not so nonsensical. Could you follow that? Okay, so please ask if there's a problem, but I guess it's not so weird. So, now let's see what happens if I have a load. So now, before we write down this operational semantics, we have to kind of think a little bit what we expect it to be. So we expect it to be that we have to, the first thing which we have to do is evaluate the address where we do the lookup. So we first have to evaluate the E. Then we get a number, hopefully, and a hopefully non-negative number, and then we may look up the value of M at that place, and this gives the new value for the R. So the new row, therefore, looks as follows. We take the old row, and then we update this old row for the R, and the new value for R is obtained in such a way that we evaluate E in row and then apply mu to it. Mu is a function, and then by that we retrieve the value which is stored at that address. So it's just that. Okay? And now for the storing, what do we expect? So that is this one. What do we expect here to be done? We first expect that the E1 is evaluated in the row, then the E2 is evaluated also in the row, and then the E1 gives us the place where mu must be updated. So therefore the row stays the same, and the mu is updated at the address which is obtained by evaluating E1, and E2 gives the value of E2, gives the value which is written there. And once again, so now you see from this formalization, please note, the formalization is not made to be maximally impressive, but to be minimally complicated, to be as simple as possible, and not to be to contain surprises, but to formalize our intuition. So, and that's always the case when you, therefore, reading this, the semantics of a programming language is often extremely boring, because it tries in mathematical language to write down our intuition. So it's the formal, and therefore we are happy that the language is small, because otherwise we would have to read more boring things. And that means also that you do not need to learn that by heart, but you kind of should realize that this is what you think it should be, and when it comes to the case, you kind of should be able to recover the formalization by yourself. Okay? Okay, so now is there any more questions on that? Now we come to the and you see here at some point that this partial definedness here, which I have not talked about anymore, again hits us here, because here at that particular place we look up the value of mu at the value of E, returned by E, and that could be negative, and then that would be undefined. And the same here, we kind of update mu at a position which might be a negative one, and then it would also be not well defined, and then that would kind of be undefined. Okay, now what is a path is kind of, then I perform one action after the other. This means I have to compose the transformations. So the first edge transforms it from state 1 to state 2, the next to state 3, and so on. And and at some point and all these transformations should be defined. If one of them is undefined, then this path as a whole is not taken. Yeah. So it is. We could say that a path is a computation, therefore, which is defined for a state S, or is simply a computation for the state S, if the composition of all these transformations is defined for S. If it's undefined, you would not go. There is a condition which is not met, and then you would not go traverse this edge. And now, if it is defined for S, then the result is the effect of this path on the program state is just compose these transformations, and that will turn out with some state, and that is the result of the computation. Okay? So, that now we know that in some sense, we have already fixed our operational semantics. So there is no more, and no more miracle. Let's see what we can do with it. So assume, so we have already the value of x plus y at some program point, here at program point u, and then we execute this computation pi. We have this path pi, and we reach a program point v. And for some reason, this v has kind of been is trying. I don't know what happened. It originally it was in the center, but it seems to move. So maybe there is a bit rot in my picture, so that it kind, or I don't know, even the, yeah, so it has started to move this week, I don't know why. And yeah, so then, so we have this pi is a path in our control flow graph, which corresponds to a it might be taken by a computation. And then we reach this other program point V, and where we again evaluate X plus Y. And now, we already had this intuition, or some of you already said, if we go there and X and Y is not modified, then X plus Y will still return the same value. And now we can kind of, we can certify that, because we observe then all the steps, X plus Y will not be modified, therefore the row will not have a change at X plus Y, and so in the end still X and Y will have the same value as before. So the not modified translates into have the same value by the operational semantics, and having the same value for X plus Y, then looking at how we determine the value of an expression, we see, and so on, if the variables have the same value, then the expression will return the same value. Yeah. So by that, the operational semantics gives us a justification to believe that the second evaluation along that path, in this case, of the expression will return the same value. Yeah. And so that was for a particular expression, now we could do that also for sets of expressions. So if I have a set of expressions at U and I move along, then for some expressions of this set, the variables will not change, will not be changed, and then those expressions for which the variables will not change, they will still be available at the program point V. So in that sense, we may say that we can speak about the whole path, but we could also say that the path is long, and what we could do is to look at not at the whole path in one go, but at individual edges. So we might wonder, if I have a single edge, and I may wonder whether, if an expression was available before that edge, will it still be available after the edge? Yeah. In that sense, now suddenly, and that comes brings us closer to the application in our compiler, it's no longer, well, we have the concrete semantics where we know what happens at the edge, but we are interested actually in the compiler. We are more interested in what happens to the expressions. Are they still available when they have been at the end of the edge, when they have been available at the before the edge? And that is something, it's also a transformation on the set of expressions which possibly are available. Now, before, the concrete semantics spoke about program states, and it could be very complicated, and has a transformation there. And now, in that, the question which the compiler then asks is, now what about other objects, which I might, other kind of properties or so, which I might attain at a particular program point, namely sets of available expressions. How do they be transformed? So in some sense it's similar to the transformation of the provided by the operational semantics for an edge. So only for other, so if you like, abstract things, and therefore they call it also something like abstract semantics, and I indicate that. So it's a transformation as for the concrete semantics, but on other objects, like sets of expressions. So this, therefore, I kind of also, since it's a transformation, I again use it, these double brackets, but I make this hash sign on top that kind of indicates now this transformation speaks not about the concrete semantics, but about those items which the compiler is interested in. And here in particular, it's available. It's sets of expressions. Okay? So I hope that this little piece of extra syntax you also might buy. And now this is a transformation which I said it's on sets of expressions, so that is more it's easier to describe because there are not so many syntactically available expressions in our program. So that is kind of an easier transformation, which is more close to what a compiler mechanically can implement. So now if I have such a transformation on these sets of expressions for each edge, I also can do the same trick as in the operational semantics. If I have a long path, I simply compose all these transformations, and then by that I mechanically have determined if I put these sets of expressions at the beginning of the path, what kind of expressions will come out at the end? Yeah, so these are kind of those which have been computed or have been available before, and whose values I may simply look up at the end of the computation without having to recompute them. So that is the information which this transformation gives me. Okay, so now the composition of such functions, okay, we somehow have a kind of an idea how that might be. So, but now let us concentrate again on a single edge, and let us just reason about if I have a set of expressions which have already been computed and the values have been stored away and I have them in my hands at the beginning of the edge. Now what set of expressions are still available at the end of the edge? So that is this single transformation which I now care about and that we kind of have to dream up. Yeah? And we look whether that is complicated or difficult. And this transformation for an edge then we will be in essence, only depend on the label of the edge. Whether I have an assignment x equals y plus z going from u to v or from u prime to v prime, the transformation will be the same. So it only depends on the label. So now here is kind of the first three things which I kind of would dream up. If you asked me, you wake me at midnight and ask me how does the no-op operation transform the set of expressions? Then I would say, the no-op has no effect. So therefore, if I apply it to a set A, then it will return the set A. And now, what happens if I have such a guard? So in order to traverse this guard, you have to evaluate the condition because you have to check it. So that means and otherwise variables do not change. So everything which is available before will be available afterwards. But we might the expression which has been evaluated for in order to check whether the guard is true or will succeed or will fail, that expression we could also store away in a register to look it up later. So therefore it is we can also add this expression to the set of available expressions. Yeah, so by that we notice that when traversing an edge, so it may happen that the set of available expressions does not change, okay, and it may also increase because some extra expression is evaluated along this edge. That could happen. And in the next case we'll show that along when traversing an edge, some expressions may also go away, so that certain expressions are no longer available. And that is the case if I would wake you in the middle of the night, you would say, clearly it goes away if one of the variables in the expression changes its value. So if I have an assignment then to a variable x, then this means that, well, I have an assignment to a variable x with the right-hand side e. Then two things happen. The right-hand side e is evaluated. So in principle, it is a candidate for an expression to be available. But at the same time, the value of the variable x changes. So this is could invalidate certain expressions. And now which expressions could it invalidate? It could invalidate expressions which have been already there before. These are in this A. Or this X could also occur in the E. So, for example, think of X equals X plus 1. Then X plus 1 is evaluated. But at the next, but since X is also changed, so I cannot... When next, further, later in my program again comes an expression x plus 1, I cannot reuse the old value because the value of x has changed. So I have to reevaluate at these other further future places the x plus 1. So you see, e has to be added to a, and then I have to remove all expressions which possibly contain x. And all these expressions which possibly contain x, I have collected in this set expressions index e, index x. This should be simply all expressions which contain x. Okay? Could you follow how that works? So the question is, that is a good question, then it depends on how smart the compiler is. So if the compiler is smart, then he would kind of identify that x equals x does not change the value of x, and so the set of expressions need not be, available expressions need not be changed. I guess what a compiler would do if there's an assignment x equals x, it would simply optimize that expression, that assignment away, and would therefore not deal with it in the available expressions analysis. And if it's so, if it's gone, then we do not have to care about it. So a very Solomonic question. Otherwise, we would have to do a lot of. Yes, so this is a very limited and very stupid analysis, and it could be improved in many, many ways. For example, you could have an addition plus 1 and addition minus 1, and then it's the same as x equals x. So you can have identity functions in disguise, in terribly many disguises, and typically it is not so difficult to fool a compiler so that the compiler would not identify the identity function. But then the question is, would the programmer kind of put, is it the goal of the programmer to fool the compiler, or is it not? So the programmer could, and typically he will. What you could do is you could write a set of small challenging programs and see how smart GCC, for example, is, whether GCC is able to detect such kind of things or not. And probably so, I guess GCC and all these others are very smart because they do a lot of transformations, and it's not so that they do one. They do them in sequence and even repetitively. So that is like that, removing this x equals x. If you do that somewhere and then this could boost analyses and optimizations which were not possible before, and so on. And so they repeatedly do these things. But it's an interesting question, how easily you can fool a transformation. So now let's see what we would do for memory lookups and and writings to memory. So for the moment, the computations which we try to save are only kind of expressions which are evaluated. They do not include loading and storing for memory. So therefore, the expression which is here in the load, which is evaluated, is only the arithmetic expression here. So we do not record that the load has been there. And the reason is because for a load is very brittle, as we have seen in the discussion yesterday. If there's a store somewhere, the question is, can we be sure that this load has not been damaged? The value at that place in memory which we have loaded has not been damaged. So therefore, in that case, we only would say E has been evaluated, and that is a potential candidate for an expression to be available. If not, E contains the variable X, because if everything which X changes its value here. And then, now for a store, there is the memory changes, but the values of the variables or the registers do not change. So therefore, in this case, only two expressions are added to the set of available expressions. Okay? So now, so having these kind of transformations dreamt up, and we can convince ourselves that they are correct in some sense, then then we can find out for every individual path, so a single path, if it were taken at runtime as a computation path, and I know that when the path starts, I have a set of variables, a set of expressions which have already been computed, then this composing these transformations gives me a way how to determine the set of expressions which have been computed and possibly are available and definitely are available at when I reach the endpoint of that path for a single path. So that is nice and might be helpful. But now comes the next problem. Dreaming up the effect for a single path is a step forward, but it's not the end of the story, because program exec. So we do not at when we look at the code statically, we have no idea which path will be taken at runtime, and in particular there could be inputs or different start points in our start states for our program, and that means the program will take different paths. Otherwise, you don't need a complicated control flow path, a control flow graph, yeah, if it's always one path which is taken. So typically, you have many different paths which are taken, and so and it could be even so. And there are two obstacles. First thing, we do not necessarily know at compile time which path is taken, so that is the first thing. And the second thing is that it's not only a finite number of paths, it's in possibly you could have loops, and so there could be infinitely many paths or unboundedly many paths. And so we have no plan at all how this analysis of a single path, how can we kind of make it into something which gives us reliable information for our program. So these are kind of the problems which we have to deal with now. So what we really require is that information here. So we have a program point V, and for that V, we want to know which expressions are available whenever I reach this program point. Is it so that on all paths which I traverse and when I reach this program point V, is it so that always X plus Y has been evaluated? That is the question which I need to know. And that is kind of, I have to take all the paths reaching the program point V from which start at start and go to V. So this is, and at start point, no expression has been evaluated. So therefore, I assume the empty set. But then I traverse, for each of these paths reaching program point V, I have a transformation starting. I apply this transformation to the empty set. This gives me a set of available expressions, and then I can only use and do an optimization with those expressions which are available on all paths. So I have to take the intersection of all these things. So that is for the transformation, I need this information. So that is the first thing. So this is, and then, so this is kind of the description, if you like, the formal description of the property which the compiler has to ensure in order to trigger the transformation. When we have that set, we can apply our transformation, which I will show you soon. But then we are on the good side for the transformation, but we have still the obligation to compute this weird expression. Yeah, and that for that we need some techniques. Yeah, so here is I have written out, spelled out in words, what it means. We do not know which path is taken at runtime, so we kind of for safety consider all paths reaching this program point V. Along each path, we can determine the set of expressions. I showed you the transformations for each edge. We can compose these transformations. And initially, we assume that no expression is available. When the program starts, nothing is we can rely on. And then what we are interested here in is information which is safe for all paths. And that means we have to take the intersection. Yeah, so that is the reason why the formula looks as it looks. And let us, so the first thing in order, I will assure you that it's amazingly that we will have a nice and simple framework to compute these kind of sets. But before we show how we compute this, the set of available expressions, let us first check how can we use this information. So if it turns out that we have no way to exploit this information, we kind of might cancel the computing the information. So let's first see how we can make use of it. So here is it. The first thing is what we want to do is when the expression E is evaluated a second time, we do not want to evaluate it. We just want to look up the value. But that means whenever an expression E is evaluated, we have to store that value away somewhere. So and that we can do in that way, that we, for every expression E, we might introduce a dedicated variable TE. The TE variable is meant to receive, to store the value of E. Yeah? So that is the idea. So that is the first thing. So I do not care about availability. I simply store away the value of every expression as soon as it has been computed. Yeah? So that means, so for an assignment, so going back here, for an assignment, that means that an assignment is split now into two assignments. The first assignment evaluates the right-hand side and stores away the values for the right-hand side. And the second one looks up that value, which we have stored away, and puts it into the X. Looking just at that, we see some depressing fact. What depressing fact do we see? At least I see a depressing fact, and that is that our effort to make the program faster makes it slower. Why? We have introduced some extra assignment. So now every assignment becomes more expensive. So this makes it's a little bit stupid. And then we have to see whether that deterioration of the program can be removed later on. So that's the first thing. And the other thing is that it is not reasonable to do that always. When is it completely stupid to introduce this TE? It is completely stupid. When the E is, when is what is? I don't know whether I understood you correctly, but did you want to say if the E is a variable itself, then it is stupid to to just copy it to some other? Yeah. So well, if E is, you mean if it's X plus Y, we also should not do it? Well, so that is a matter of taste. So. When the TE we should introduce for those expressions which we consider as complicated and worthwhile to improve upon. And that is so that the compiler may choose as it wants. The compiler may say, okay, constants are something which I do in an atomic step. It doesn't make sense to introduce an TE for a constant. Or it may say, oh, for my architecture, producing a constant is a complicated operation because it takes several instructions of my assembly language to produce a constant. This is the case in, I think, even in the power, is it in the power PC? So at least in some, when you have a fixed size of instructions, then, say, 32 bits, and you want to create a 32-bit constant, then this is not so easy, because how can you do it? You cannot write load and then spell out the constant, because the constant itself is 32-bit. So such kind of constants you have to break into two, in the left half, in the high part and the low part, and then add them in two instructions. So you may consider it meaningful to produce. Once you have produced the constant, to keep it in a register if you use this constant several times. And so that means even a constant, so you might have a TE for a constant. In other architectures, constants are more or less for free, so you don't need it. So it is a design choice for which expressions you should introduce such a register TE. And you could kind of do it. Also, so if E is a variable, typically it is completely stupid. Because so if E is X, so is or is Y, then you would introduce an auxiliary variable just taking the value of Y. So it's just copying. So that's completely stupid. So that you should not do. Yeah? And for constants, as I said, it is sometimes it is worthwhile, sometimes it is not. For small constants, typically it is not. For large constants, it might. And also for the what you said, X plus Y, you are also, in that sense, you are right. For many processors, addition is so cheap, it doesn't make sense to store it away and to spend a precious register to keep addition. But if the expression is more complicated, you might think of it, of doing, instead of recalculating, investing in a register. So it depends. As usual, it depends. So it's a design choice. Okay? So the same now for conditions. So if the expression E is just a variable or something very trivial, we might not want to apply this introduce an extra auxiliary register TE. But if it's a complicated expression, we might. We might want to store away the value of that expression and only use the TE then for doing the check. And the same here for the loads and the stores. There are also expressions and we might decide to put them in registers before we apply the load or store. Okay. Now what does that mean? So that is the preparation. And now comes the second part of the transformation, and the second part does the following. It tries to, when E is available at the start point of an edge, what does it mean? It means that the value of E has been stored in TE. And that is, if there is another assignment, TE equals E, then this would assign the same value to TE. So that is ridiculous. So why should we do it? So we then do nothing simply. Yeah, that is the optimization. Now we save something. You see, an assignment has been removed. Okay. So now let us look here at this little example to see how that would look like. So the example is so simple that we can that our methods already are successful to already sufficient to deal with it. So the program is this little block, this little sequence of assignments. So you see x equals y plus 3, x equals 7, and then z equals y plus 3. So what do we see? So we see first that x is over is assigned twice, so that is so therefore this value which we have computed would not survive in the variable x because x receives a different value in between. But after our preliminary transformation, we might introduce an auxiliary variable or register t to receive the value of y plus 3. So therefore, this assignment is split in these two assignments. And likewise, this assignment here is split in these two assignments. Okay? So that would be the transformation T1. And for the constant 7, I have considered that as a small constant, which is not worthwhile to invest a register for. Okay? So that is the pre-processing, and now come then I may determine the set of available expressions. So the set of available expressions tells me that we at that point here nothing is available. Then we traverse this edge here. That the right-hand side is returns y plus 3, so this is added to the set of available expressions. So then y is not assigned to, so therefore this set is available through all the program points in that program until that point. So at that point here, y plus 3 is available, therefore the assignment t equals y plus 3 is superfluous because we know that t already will contain the value y plus 3. So therefore we can remove this assignment. Okay? And that means here at that place we simply access set receives the value of t where we have safely stored the value of y plus 3. Okay, so at least in this little example, we saw that we gained something. So we have invested also something. We have invested this one. Now, so that is the idea of the transformation. This T1 followed by this T11 followed by T12, and now we may wonder whether this transformation really preserves the correctness of the program. So that the first thing is that this transformation, so we have two transformations, so for each of them we may wonder whether the semantics is preserved. Now it's a little bit there is this transformation T11 is what does it do? Is it introduces extra auxiliary variables, so and extra program points, but that means so in, if we want to know is the program before and the program afterwards the same, then we are a little bit in trouble. Why? Because we have to compare apples with pears. The two programs now have different sets of program points and different sets of variables. So how can you we compare two programs which are in that sense completely different? Also, what we did was completely simple. We still changed the programs in a way which, at least in a mathematical sense, they are not equivalent. So what can us help us? Why now should we be depressed and kind of give up the lecture and go home and go to bed, drink a lot of alcohol? What should we, so what is the problem here? So the first thing is, in fact, so we should be a little bit careful what we mean by being, we should be less ambitious, so that's okay. when we want to prove that two things are the same, it's not so that they must be, have the same set of variables and the same set of program points. So in fact, it depends on what is relevant. They must only be equivalent in a relevant way. And if I introduce auxiliary variables and nobody cares about these auxiliary variables, then their values we should not matter, and that means we only should compare for the other variables. And that here, in this case, the after this T11, the equivalence only holds if you restrict the program points, the program states, to the variables which originally have been there, and if we ignore the values of the auxiliary variables. So that is the first thing. And the second thing is, we have introduced new program points, and we will not be interested in the values in the states at these new program points, but only in the states at the old program points. And then we can prove, yes, at the whenever we reach one of these old program points, then the states will have the same values for the old variables. And in that sense, nothing has changed. Yeah? So therefore, if when I said here lightheartedly, transformation T11 preserves the semantics, then it only preserves the semantics in precisely this sense, with respect to the old program points and the old variables, and not with respect to the new ones, because they have not been there before. Okay? So I hope this kind of shows to you that one has to be a little bit careful with what it means for the old the program before the transformation and after the transformation to be the same. They are not the same. They can only be the same with equal. They may only equally well serve our purposes. So that is the thing which we have to check. Okay? Or so that is a small thing, but it is kind of should give you some idea. Now assume that this transformation T11 has been applied and everything is fine. Now the question is whether the second transformation also preserves the semantics. The second transformation is in that sense easier, as the program points stay the same and the variables, the set of variables, does not change. The only thing is that at some places simply an assignment is dropped. So that is the only thing which we have to check there. And that, so we have to look at when an assignment is dropped, does that kind of has an impact or not? And then it turns out that in these places, so we have to verify whenever such an assignment is dropped, a value would be written into a variable which is already there. And that is something which we now can prove by induction on the length of the execution. And that is kind of something like what you kind of considered or asked about what happens if x is assigned the value x. This is something like that here. T is assigned a value which is already there. So it's an identity somehow. And then we can safely skip it. Yeah. So that is what we have to, if we want to be. So the argument would be somehow like that. If assume that at the we have such an execution reaching a program point U, and E is available at U, that as in the way how we have designed this availability, it was the intersection of all the availabilities for all paths. This means that in particular, E is contained, is available along this particular path, pi. And that means that this pi must provide the expression E, and that is, it can be decomposed in such a way, there is some initial segment of this path, then there is an then there is an edge where this expression E is computed, and there is another path where no variable in the expression is modified. Yeah. So once again, the expression E is evaluated somewhere on this path, and later on, E is not removed from the set of available expressions, and that means no variable of E receives a new value. And from that, we then can conclude, using the operational semantics, that the register TE still contains the value of E when E when U is reached. And that means that whether or not this assignment X equals whether or not the assignment an assignment X equals E is executed. No, whether or not the assignment TE equals E is executed or not does not make a difference. Yeah. So that is for the correctness. And just once more, we have discussed that, but I have here put it also into the slides this kind of transformation is only meaningful for expressions E which are not variables and for which the evaluation is heavy enough for that a repetition of the evaluation pays off. That the removal of the evaluation pays off, so that the repetition should be avoided. So there's one thing here: we have just expressions like arithmetic expressions for index calculations, for example, which might be removed. There are other applications like think of you have. Security is you have runtime checks whether, for example, you have enough privileges for doing a certain operation. So these kind of checks could be very expensive. And once you have once checked that you have all required privileges for an operation in some security model, then you can keep that in mind and need not check your privileges again. So this is a more complicated and another form of more complicated operations and a more complicated form of application, but where the same transformation, the same optimization would help to improve your code to avoid unnecessary extra operations. So I guess for today we are done. I may announce Stefan wanted to put online an exercise sheet, so which kind of allows to, I think it's in the Moodle, so that one can play around a little bit with control flow graphs. And so there will be such a tutorial tomorrow at 10, as announced. But next week, I will be on a conference. So next week, there will be no lecture. And I guess there will also be no tutorial because Stefan is also up in the way. But then the week afterwards, I hope I meet you again, and then we will continue with the lecture. Thank you.